to issue an arrest warrant for the captain of the South Korean ferry, which sank on Wednesday morning. It's been confirmed that he wasn't steering the ship when the incident happened. Investigators say the third officer was in charge instead.
The captain should have been in the wheelhouse. However, he was not in a position where he could have led the steering when the incident happened. We believe he was at the back of the wheelhouse.
25 people are confirmed dead. Around 270 others are still missing. A powerful earthquake has struck central and southern Mexico. Measuring 7.2, was centred northwest of the beach resort of Acapulco, where many Mexicans are on holiday for Easter. The quake was also felt strongly in Mexico's capital, but there are no immediate reports of injuries or damage. That's the latest. I'm Chris Giles.
Love Bristol, love BCFM 93.2.
Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping me review this week's news is Labour councillor for Eastville, Vary, Threlfall. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, legal challenges to the spooks obsessed with knowing all our passwords and cracking all our antivirus software and encryption like we are the enemy. Internet Freedom Campaign, the Open Rights Group, are in Bristol next Thursday evening, and we hear what it's all about from their executive director. They're doing what they can to keep the internet free and to keep the spooks from our private information. And Ukraine hots up, with armed groups taking over many cities in eastern Ukraine. With May's elections looming, ethnic Russians look like they don't trust Kiev to play fair. Just how far right is the new government in Kiev, and why is Nick Clegg and the EU so enthusiastic for them, if they are? Plus, an extended interview with Britain's top media rights campaigner, Granville Williams, from the Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom, who brings us up to speed with who owns Britain's media today. What's happening to Mr. Murdoch after his failed bid to take over B-Sky B? He's now looking elsewhere. And how's it all being affected by the internet titans? That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, clear and dry. This weekend, at temperatures around 12, 14 degrees Celsius, quite warm, mostly sunny, a little windy on Sunday. Next week, hovering around 15 Celsius, cloud cover and rain is mostly cloudy with some rain until Wednesday, brightening up Thursday and Friday next week. Next weekend, that's the 26th and 27th of April, temperatures dropping to 11 or 12 Celsius. Quite a cloudy and rainy weekend next weekend, so make the most of it this Easter weekend. Week after next, cloudy start to the week with rain midweek and brightening up again as we go into May. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Labour councillor at Eastville, Vary Threlfall. Hi, Vary. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, Tony.
On this sunny Good Friday. First of all, tell us about what got you interested in politics. You're quite young. How old are you?
I've just turned 25, yeah.
And what got you interested in politics?
I was actually interested because I wanted to make a change, essentially, and the change was in the local community, and I saw actually politics has been a great way and a great facilitator to make those changes.
Now, that's not a Bristol accent, is it?
No.
Whereabouts are you from?
I'm originally from Edinburgh. I've lived in Bristol for about 7 or 8 years.
Okay.
And just love the city.
And why the Labour Party? You know, yes, you want to make a change. Yes, you get into politics. But why Labour and not one of the others?
Labour reflects a lot of my political values and a lot of my personal values, both in terms of social mobility and economic. So I'm a social economist. I'm Keynesian economics.
Okay, well, just a minute. What do you mean by social mobility, first of all?
Why social mobility?
Yeah, what do you mean by it when you say it?
What do I mean by it?
I mean, that means you want to change jobs. Actually, I can understand that can be quite difficult. But you mean in class or what?
I want to enable people to be able to reach their potential. Social mobility is incredibly important because you shouldn't be judged on where you come from. You should be judged on your ability. And I think enabling people to be able to reach those, to enable them to reach
Potential.
Yeah, that's the word I was thinking. Yeah.
Yeah. But the thing is, a lot of people level at the Labour Party the criticism of, well, it's just Tory light, really. I mean, a lot of the economic policies are the same. Yes, they are a little bit critical of the cuts and austerity, but actually, when they get into power, if they get into power, they'll probably do just the same.
No, I would challenge that. I would completely challenge that. I think the Labour Party demonstrates an alternative. The austerity, the Conservative government talks a lot about austerity measures. We challenge that as a solution, and in fact believe that there's other ways of being able to progress towards economic recovery, but at the same time enable jobs and enable people to come out of the recession.
Well, yes, but how? Because how are you going to afford it? I mean, this is the trouble, isn't it? It's all very well talking the talk, but, you know, if Labour gets into power nationally or in the city, how is it going to walk the walk? Because there isn't enough money to go around, it seems.
People say there's not enough money to go around, but actually it's about the distribution of that wealth. Paying people a fair wage, paying people a living wage, they then spend that in their local economy. That then, you know, enables economic growth, both in the local context and a national context.
But a lot of employers, particularly locally here, will tell you that we just can't afford to anymore. We're in a recession. We can't actually put wages up. We'd like to, but we can't afford to do it.
Well, I would challenge that. I mean, research has shown and demonstrated actually that we can afford to pay a living wage. By paying living wages, they're then spent in local businesses, and so therefore profits are increasing, and therefore we're able to pay higher wages. At the moment, what we've got is we've got wealth in the hands of few and not the many, and actually that redistribution of wealth and ensuring that people are being paid a fair wage. And I think the council certainly can lead on that by example, by paying their employees a living wage, means that will translate into economic growth.
Well, they certainly could set an example. But surely Britain's always been like this, Fari, hasn't it? I mean, you know, a feudal system, you know, with the barons and all that kind of thing in medieval times. There's always been this kind of class of people that own and run everything, and the rest are just sort of scrabbling for the crumbs from the table.
I would challenge that. I mean, I don't think anyone would want to go back to the feudal system, and I think, there is an alternative, and as long as people have a voice, they should speak up and they should start challenging things. I mean, that's what got me involved in politics, was that I saw that something was wrong and I stood up and I challenged it.
Well, go on, tell us about that specific incident, because that's fascinating to know. Mm. Something that actually gets you to such an extent you think, right, I really am going to move on this.
Well, the issue is in itself one that's, I suppose, considered quite controversial. It's prostitution, basically. I saw it. The way it was damaging a lot of women. I did some volunteer work with 125 and spoke with some of the women, a lot of the women around kind of Fishponds, Lower Fishponds Road. And it was just disgraceful that anyone could get that to that point where they were so desperate. A lot of them come from backgrounds where they're domestically abused. A lot of them come from really horrific situations. And the very fact that society wasn't helping them, the very fact that there wasn't any way in which we could support these women, just amazed me. I find that incredible.
I mean, surely someone, if they're choosing, and prostitution, I mean, maybe that's the wrong word to use, but if they make that choice, surely there is an alternative, which is simply to go on benefits of some time. I mean, I know many of them are drug users, so to go into a treatment centre or that kind of thing.
I'm not quite sure what you mean. I mean, prostitution is the right word, I think, because what we're talking about is we're talking about street workers and we're talking about desperation. There's not another option for many of them. Look at the cuts in benefits. They are particularly hitting women and women with children. A lot of them, as I say, are forced out into the streets by partners and by abusive partners. We need to invest in frontline workers in order to ensure that we are intervening in situations and supporting in terms of domestic abuse, but also providing adequate support for the women. At the moment, very few places will take in women who are involved in prostitution or in similar careers. So I think, and similar jobs, sorry, in that sort of sector, it's very difficult for those women to get out of prostitution and make their
life.
Well,
it's fascinating because you really obviously know quite a lot about this subject. What ways are there for women to, if, say, when they've had enough of doing that, to get out of it? And I wonder, are these also affected by government cuts?
Yes, so I mean, at the moment, 125 does incredible work and works very well with those women. Of course, they rely on fundraisers, they rely on getting kind of funding through those sorts of resources. In order to prevent women getting to that point, we need to invest in domestic abuse services also, and that's not happening. At the moment, it was disputed. We raised the point that we thought in the last budget that domestic abuse services might be cut. They weren't being cut, but they're not being invested in either. And actually, we need to invest in these core services in order to ensure that the women are protected. And the very fact that more women are getting into this situation because they're being made redundant or they're having their suffering from the likes of the bedroom tax means that they're finding themselves in these desperate situations and they're having to turn to other alternatives to make money.
What are the sort of things that you've come across as issues in Eastville since you've been a councillor since, was it last May?
Yes, I was elected last May. There's been a broad range of issues. I tried to take a much more proactive rather than a reactive response. So I looked at kind of the core issues that have been there for the last 12 to 15 years. And they include things like, for instance, fly tipping, drug and sex litter, certainly under the M32. We've had issues in terms of Fishbourne's High Street is kind of been going downhill, so kind of looking at actually reinvigorating that. We had an issue recently where Bristol East in its entirety was removed from the Visit Bristol website. So we campaigned.
Why did they tell you why?
Well, it was a bit controversial, actually. I mean, on Twitter, what was said to one of my one of the people that were quite active in Neighbourhood Partnership, what was said to them was that it's only houses. And we disputed that heavily. There's a huge amount of history around fish ponds. There's fantastic green spaces, so a great area for ecotourism. And so we fought back. And, I mean, John Hurst was fantastically accommodating. I had a meeting with him. He was like, I have no idea why this has happened. And within seconds working with local residents, we managed to get it back on the Visit Bristol website. The hard work of those residents and the Destination Bristol East website, we've now produced leaflets, which are in the Tourist Information Office, detailing different areas within Bristol East. So that's fantastic. But it's about realising and getting the council to recognise that, you know, East Bristol does exist. It deserves the same core services as every other part of this city. It deserves fair access to public transport. It deserves to have its high streets regenerated. It deserves to have its parks maintained. It deserves to have children and youth services, which currently, again, have been cut. And it's only through community activism that we even have children's services within my ward. And it's just ridiculous. I mean, we need serious investment. We really do.
Okay, what about the mayor? Because really, I mean, a lot of people say, well, there's not much point in electing councillors nowadays because George is in charge. He's the daddy.
I would disagree. At the moment, councillors play a pinnacle role in keeping the mayor accountable. We ensure things like, for instance, his budget are adequately scrutinised. We ensure things like, for instance, the recent bylaw debacle where they were trying to prevent people like children playing in parks, that they're not pushed through full council without previous scrutiny.
Okay, tell us about that, because I'd heard a bit about that, but I mean, if you know a bit more, I mean, I've heard this over the years, you know, children in parks are a problem, antisocial behaviour, you know, we've got to clamp down on them. What is the real problem, and what were the council and George intending to do about it?
So the problems that were suggested was that children obviously make noise when they play. Children climb trees, which of course they do, which could be a liability, all these sorts of things. I mean, my personal suspicion is that obviously George has invested a lot in these makes Sunday special schemes, which obviously has cost over £100,000 to run in 2013. Now, why would you go to a park if the centre is closed for a day? And I think there's been a lot of almost disinvestment in parks and investment in closing the streets for a day.
So what was the intention in the parks then? What was going
to
happen?
The intention was to prevent children from doing what children do. And I thought, I find that remarkable. I mean, we can't. And I think Gus Hoyt's response was, oh, well, people will ignore those laws anyway. But the question is, why have them in the first place? I think we really needed to consider actually what parks are used for and ensure that actually any bylaws that we have enable all users to use the park in a fair way.
And I can remember now, five or six years ago, the Green Party circulating something about clamping down on noise and skateboarding on College Green. And I sent a message to them saying, this looks like green fascism to me. So I'm a bit disturbed to hear that Gus was saying, oh, well, don't worry about the laws. They probably won't be enforced anyway. You know, I mean, this the law of the land is something to be taken seriously. What were you able to do about it?
So they were pulled, and they didn't come before a full council. So we protested, and they've been brought back in for review, which is fantastic.
Okay, what about the cuts generally, though? Because there have been cuts, there have been privatisations, home care last year, various things. You know, what's your perspective of the state of play in the city, when it comes to the effect that austerity is having, whether it's to do with actually cutting amounts of money or whether it's pushing things out to the private sector, where, you know, what happens then is that the council officers and the officials just go, oh, well, sorry, it's nothing to do with us.
It's having a clear effect. And I think it's even having an effect on those council officers, because they're having more work to do with less time, which means that work is not being done. There's a huge list in terms of kind of for traffic and transport, so getting roads done. There's now only going to be able to do one project a year and things like that. So we're not going to be able to fix roads. We're not able to provide children's services as a big one.
But you've got
services.
Potholes. I mean, just where I am in Portland Square, there's a hole appeared in the road about 2 months ago. It's like some sort of sinkhole thing. A giant great hole appeared in the side of the road, and the council have done absolutely nothing about it. What they've done is fenced it off with a few railings, and now everybody has to, including mothers with babies, have to push the chairs into the road and round. Still nothing's happening. So what on earth is going on?
It's budgets, and it's all down to the budgets to fix these things. At the moment, central government cuts means that we've, as a result, cut those budgets, cut the number of staff. I mean, certainly, I know the officer for my ward, for my area of the city, works incredibly hard, but he can only do what's within his capacity as one person. And I just don't think we're putting enough investment. And we can't put enough investment because, again, it's all down to Eric Pickles and what he's saying in terms of local government funding.
So Eric Pickles is the minister for what exactly? Is local government, but is it the environment still?
No, he's not the Minister for Environment still.
No, OK, Martin, maybe you can help us out here. What is Pickles?
What is Eric Pickles for? There's a question.
Who knows?
I don't know what his exact title is, Tony. I'll
have a look. But anyway, can you give us your take on some of this, Martin? Because, you know, we're hearing a lot about problems with cuts, government cuts, central government cuts, local government cuts. What are your thoughts about all that?
Well, when the banks collapsed in 2008... I've said, well, what's got to happen here is that the people at the bottom of the pile shouldn't have anything cut at all as a result of this. And if there is any budget that we've got to make any shortfalls up, it's got to be those who pollute a pays principle. It's got to be the wealthy classes that will pay. And in fact, Greg Filo from Glasgow University put forward a very interesting idea. He said, well, look, you know, what used to happen in the Hundred Years' War or whatever, there was no income tax. And so the government would just say, right, we want to everybody's wealth. We've got a budget deficit of X. We now need Y from those with money. And because the state has stepped in to bail you out, you now must bail the state out without expecting anything back. In other words, the bottom half of the population shouldn't have had to take any kind of cut at all. But of course, what subsequently happened is this idea that there's not enough money, and it's gradually seeped into people's consciousness. Oh, there's not enough money. There's not enough money. And Vari will know, as an economist, that that's simply deluded. In actual fact, national economies don't function like that. And when you get people coming on this show or in the mainstream media going on about, well, you can't spend what you haven't got. Well, I used to teach economics, and frankly, the first thing you learn at advanced level is it doesn't work like that. It's rather more complicated.
So you're saying that George Osborne is more of a sort of O-level chap?
Well, I mean, don't
maybe
forget,
he wouldn't even pass that. As someone who's, you said right at the very start that you're into this Keynesian economics. What is that? What does it mean?
What does it mean? Essentially, it means the complete opposite of what the current government's doing. It's probably out my own personal knowledge, but essentially what it means is that
difficult, isn't it? Some of this economic stuff is difficult because I think, in a way, it's deliberately difficult for people to get their heads around. Martin, can you help out a bit?
Well, it's
Keynes.
It's very hard to boil it down into a sentence.
Well, you do it.
I'll try and boil it down into a paragraph because that's the sort of scale you need to think of. Keynes basically said if you cut during a crisis, you're actually going to make the situation worse. And if you think about it, that's what was going on for several years. The reason why the economy's turned the corner in the last year is because of an election coming, they've decided to ease back on the cuts, and therefore the economy starts to pick up again. Now, can't people see what's going on here? When you bang your head on a brick wall, it's nice when you stop, but it's nothing to do with the austerity that's gone before. But people like old-fashioned doctors were using leeches and bleeding, they get the view that the reason why we're recovering now is because we had lots of bleeding and leeches. In actual fact, the reason we're recovering now is because we've stopped doing bleeding and leeches. We're pumping money into the system all the time. We're giving people subsidies to buy houses under Help to Buy. They've just released people's pensions pots to be spent. And of course things start to pick up. But what they're doing is they're channeling this money through their political supporters. Give more money to those who've already got money, so we'll try and push ourselves over the line in 2015.
Also, just let me say, I wasn't that far wrong, because Eric Pickles is the Secretary of State for Communities and Local Government. Let's have a look at some of this week's news stories, and we'll start with Google. This is just today. Google are under fire from a European media tycoon. We'll be hearing more about media tycoons after six, but the boss of one of Europe's largest media companies has strongly criticised Google, the BBC says, in an open letter printed in a German newspaper. Matthias Dopfner, chief executive of Axel Springer, said his company is afraid of Google and its power. He asks in the letter, addressed to the Google boss, Eric Schmidt, whether Google intends to create a super state where antitrust and privacy laws don't apply. Google hasn't commented on the letter. This guy, Axel Springer, publishes more than 200 newspapers and magazines, including German paper Die Welt and Bild, has a significant online presence in television and radio interviews. Vari, what he's saying is they're trying to create a super state with this, and also that Google is actually building up a monopoly.
I find it incredibly interesting, actually, because if you look at Google, I mean, it does in many ways have enormous power. I mean, they've developed a very unique algorithm, so a way of searching for certain terms, and they've expanded slowly but surely into other sectors. So they are in many ways, and I'm sure this is in their business plan, developing monopoly, because they see it as a way of, you know, their search engines, etc., gathering data so that they can then sell products to those. I mean, they're doing their market research and selling their product in the same sweep.
Well, one of the other things they do is they scan all the emails that you send through Gmail, looking for keywords and content. They have a look at everything that you're saying in order to target advertising at you, and then also possibly to sell that information about you to potential advertisers. So that's something that the Americans, in the American courts, they've been trying to challenge recently. Google has played a very clever game and divide and rule in stopping them getting a class action together, for example. Martin, Google is getting more and more powerful, and I know when I first started using it back in the late 1990s, I remember thinking, gosh, this is a pretty snazzy web search engine. It just does exactly what I want it to do, which was things like it caches pages when a website's down. Google's got a copy of it. You can look at a website even after it's gone down, and there didn't seem to be much to touch it. Also, as a guy called Matthew Cutts, who was one of the Google developers, who was seconded from the National Security Agency to work at Google. Now, all this stuff we've been hearing about Edward Snowden, I wonder whether Google is just a front-end kind of shop for the National Security Agency.
Well, if you think about the way the internet developed, it was developed basically by government expenditure in the US on military planning. for how are we going to survive a nuclear war and keep our communications going. And they chucked money at it via the universities for decades. And eventually they build up an infrastructure which is big enough. And of course Google, Google is the best search engine of all. You try and use other search engines, it's not as good. And of course the point is, monopoly is built into this. And then and what's happened is it's basically been created. I mean, they go on about Tim Berners-Lee inventing the internet. I mean, he may have invented the idea of
the
internet.
Well, he invented some protocols.
Yes, I know, but the point is that for this to work, you have to have years and years and years of investment by the state. And in actual fact, modern technology does function like that. It isn't some guy in his bedroom or his backyard coming up with stuff. If you want to control future streams of income, you've got to plan ahead. And that's effectively what the state, the corporate state in the US, did. And they basically then hand this out to their loyal barons. So for example, Microsoft agreed with the NSA at the very early stages that Windows would have a backdoor in that would allow the NSA to look at everything, and that's the only basis on which Bill Gates was allowed to proceed. Now, this has got nothing to do with the free market bit of your economics textbook, but it is the real world.
Now, Vari, you're the Labour councillor for Eastville. Mr. Dopfner, this German media baron's comments were not just restricted to Google. The founder of social network Facebook also came under fire from him. He explained that he'd been at a conference when somebody asked Mark Zuckerberg how Facebook stored data and protected users' privacy, and Zuckerberg replied, "I do not understand your question. Those who have nothing to hide have nothing to fear." A bit of a creepy thing to say. Again and again, I had to think about this sentence. It's terrible. I know it's certainly not meant that way. It's a mindset that was fostered in totalitarian regimes, not in liberal societies. And he's saying that about Facebook.
Yeah, it's really concerning, isn't it, that Zuckerberg has shown such kind of almost disregard for privacy.
Because they're torn, privacy. Aren't they? I mean, these companies are torn between the users, who often don't pay anything, they're just free users, and the NSA, National Security Agency, and GCHQ, the people who are kind of behind the internet. And also, they are constantly having lawsuits against people like Google if they don't comply. So they're basically, it's like a kind of bully boy tactic. If you don't hand over the data we want, then we're going to take you to a secret court somewhere. So a bit of a frightening relationship between them. But they're being torn between the public and the spooks. Seems to me they pretty much put their hat down on the wrong side. Anyway, David Cameron, Jesus invented the big society. I am just continuing God's work. Well, this was, I think, Thursday before last, David Cameron did this, said this, and it was at a meeting at Downing Street for a whole load of Christian, the great and good of the country that he brought to Downing Street. So is he right, Vari? Jesus invented the big society 2,000 years ago, and he is just basically doing God's work.
It's incredible, isn't it? I mean, I'm so incredulous that, you know, David Cameron could utter such a thing. I think, you know, if you're Christian, it's certainly blasphemous. If you're not Christian, I think there's some serious issues around narcissism there in terms of, you know, what he thinks his role in the world is. I'm surprised he didn't go as far as to say, you know, this is the second coming, and here I am. I was incredulous that he was able to give this sort of speech.
Well, one of the most amazing things about it, certainly of what I see, is that, you know, that a lot of the clergy, Archbishop Welby, and who's the new Archbishop, the former oil man, and Giles Fraser from St Paul's, haven't really done much criticism. There was a headline from Giles Fraser saying, "Bless you, David Cameron." You know, so not a lot of criticism from the church. Yeah. But you know, we're in a situation, aren't we? We've just seen it in the front page of the Independent. Earlier this week, food poverty, the scandal that shames Britain. Nearly a million people are now relying on handouts to eat, and benefit reforms are to blame. 600 religious leaders, at least some of them anyway, not the ones that were David Cameron's talk, it seems, combining to condemn the 163% increase in food banks use in the past year. Martin, I know your mum's a clergywoman, isn't she?
Retired.
What would she make, and what do you make of this?
Well, I think this is politics by Cameron, because he knows that the churches are actually on the warpath about this food poverty issue.
So he's just
they are in the front line
counter-strike
of the failure of the welfare reforms. I mean, you could argue that the welfare reforms aren't failing, they're doing what they're designed to do, which is make life a misery for the people in the bottom of the pile. And I come back to what we were talking about earlier on the economy. There is no case whatsoever for the people on the bottom of the pile to have lost anything at all as a result of this crisis. If we're going to bail the banks out, as we did, at that point you turn round to the wealthy classes whose assets are being protected by QE. Because we could have just followed a free market policy and allowed it all to go down the drain. We didn't do that. But that means that those with assets, the minority in this society who do have assets, they have to pay. And the people at the bottom 50% shouldn't have had to pay at all. So the whole idea, what they've done now is they've turned it into this morality play, and they're going to try and reform the morals of the people on the bottom of the pile. People like the young women that we were talking about earlier who end up in prostitution through a series of concatenation of circumstances. Why should they pay for the crisis? There's no case for that at all. And when the Tories were first elected with a liberal tail, as it were, I thought they had a chance here to demonstrate that they could clean up the city, because they were the party of the city, a bit like, you know, Tony Blair cleaning up the unions or whatever. But there was no evidence that they've shown any interest in that at all. They're completely in the pocket of their paymasters, the hedge funds and the banks, and they are carrying out their will.
This is all taking place, the food poverty, the scandal that shames Britain in a country, Vari, which is the seventh richest on the planet.
The sixth richest, yeah. Oh. I find it absolutely disgraceful that in an economy where, we've got more millionaires every year, we've got incredible innovation. I mean, certainly in the southwest, we're one of the, outside of London, we're the second largest economy, that people are still having to turn to food banks, and in fact that they can't actually feed themselves. They're having to choose between eating, sleeping and heating. It's absolutely disgraceful, and absolutely I concur with what was being said earlier, that, you know, these benefit reforms are hitting people hard. The bedroom tax, for instance, is hitting people hard, and it's just absolutely disgraceful that we have any sort of hunger crisis. The widening gap in inequality needs to be challenged, and we need to be here, and we need to be challenging, particularly in Bristol.
Well, what the Conservatives will say, because I don't really think the Lib Dems have featured much in a lot of the economic policy, they sort of seem to be scratching their heads by the sidelines, wondering what's going on, and wonder if they're going to lose the election, the next election, what they should do. At the end of the day, what they're trying to do is just get rid of the welfare state. They think the country can run without the welfare state, and that those who don't have much, maybe who are a bit ill, can do a little bit of part-time work and just manage like that, that the welfare state is a luxury we can't afford anymore.
Yeah, I've heard that argument before. The wealth will trickle down. Unfortunately, a lot of these people, I mean, they do have jobs. They've a lot of people that are turning to food banks have part-time jobs, full-time jobs, and yet they're still not being able to feed their families. I mean, it's disgraceful. People are not being paid a fair wage, and many of them are working for large companies that are making large profits. Why is there not any translation? And the reason there's no translation is because the government is not interfering. The government is not saying people, yes, should be paid a fair wage. And if they're out of work, it's not welfare, it's not benefits, it's social security. And actually, they should be entitled to enough money to be able to live on.
Now, you said the sixth richest economy. I said the seventh richest economy. Let's not squabble over it. But, I mean, when I did the research to find that figure, the seventh, that was around about August, September last year. I wonder, Martin, whether Britain's actually creeping up the level of league table of general overall wealth, but the poor are going right down, basically over a cliff.
Well, let's think about the macroeconomics of this for a minute. Having a welfare state is not a kind of decision taken out of kindness or fairness. Having a welfare state is an absolutely essential part of a modern capitalist economy, and it has been for the last 50 or 60 years, because what it means is that the business cycle is smoothed out. So as the economy goes into crash mode, as it did in 2008, then all of the spending on benefits goes up. Now that's good, because that actually cushions the economy against the shock. In South Africa, where they have no benefits for anybody, black or white, apart from very limited handouts, when the economy goes into crisis, everything falls through the floor, straight down. And there's a real danger that you can carry on going down. I used to work in the Eastern Bloc, and when they were forming the Russian economy, there was no welfare safety net. So when they started privatising and cutting, people fell out of the society and went straight down the drain. Mm-hmm. That was very bad for those people, but it was also bad for the economy. A welfare state protects the economy against crashes, just as having a progressive income tax system protects you against inflation, because as wages rise, people pay more in taxes, and that prevents wage inflation. So a welfare state, as properly managed in places like Norway, is an essential part of a successful capitalist economy. It's not an optional add-on, it's an essential part, which is why all of this attack on the welfare state is so misconceived. It's completely economically illiterate, apart from being unfair.
One of our big local financial firms, Hargreaves Lansdown, has been in the news over the last few weeks. The Telegraph seemed to have been really spearheading a campaign to expose some problems at the firm. Hargreaves Lansdown is Britain's biggest investment shop, has scrapped plans to increase charges. This is in early February, so it's a couple of months ago, to increase charges for savers that prefer to buy investment trusts over unit trusts or other open-ended funds. The firm, founded by billionaires Peter Hargreaves and Stephen Lansdown, has ushered in a number of new fees when it unveiled its new charging structure last month. One of the new fees introduced was to change the way it charges customers who hold investment trusts. But basically what's happened here is that the regulator has said to them, you cannot charge for those things. And as a result, we have another story just last week where the bank's top complaints league, but Hargreaves Lansdown, sees a surge in complaints. They're saying Hargreaves Lansdown has actually had a six-fold surge in complaints. Well, this is one of the mainstays of the local economy, Martin, isn't it, Hargreaves Lansdown? I mean, just tell us a little bit about how they fit in to the city, and they do seem to be having problems. One of the other stories the Telegraph's got is that the shares have been down 7% despite a huge Royal Mail recruitment to them. So they were involved in the Royal Mail sell-off, and they got loads of new customers, but their shares are down 7%.
Well, as one of the big players in the hedge fund industry, they are as vulnerable as the rest of the industry to the problems of the industry itself. A lot of what they are selling is essentially fictitious. And if for example, if we had
a share is not fictitious.
No,
is it?
If the government in 2008 had decided to let RBS go down, and the banking system to cleanse itself, this is a free market policy. This is the policy pursued by the von Mises Institute or the real free marketeers, the Hayekians. Just let it go down, and then we'll see the consequences. Businesses like Hargreaves Lansdown would have gone in the tsunami that would have followed. So they wouldn't be sitting there being a successful company and telling everybody in Bristol what to do and what the best things to do are. They would have been bankrupted. They weren't bankrupted because the state, the wicked state, stepped in and bailed them out. This can't be emphasised enough. The only reason why we have a private financial industry at all is because we stepped in and bailed it out.
Okay,
in 2008.
Martin, why are those shares fictional? As far as I can see, they're not. If you invested in a unit trust, they're invested in...
No, the value of those shares is fictional because it's all based upon QE. QE, of course, is not a conventional policy. The government
This is printing money.
Yeah, they're basically pumping money in. Mm. The purpose of QE is to preserve the asset values of the asset-owning classes. So, in other words, we're not going to allow people to go bankrupt, which is a free market policy. We're going to bail them out and keep them in business in the hopes that then the economy will gradually turn a corner and pick up. But, of course, the problem with that is that you haven't got the natural mechanism of capitalism working. Basically, you know, Hargreaves Lansdown playing fast and loose, like most of them were, you are going to be wiped out. We're going to go back to boring old banks that just take deposits and give loans. None of this fancy stuff. That's all wiped out for a generation. That's what's supposed to happen under a capitalist setup. That's not what happened. They were bailed out. And not only have they not been restructured, they've become arrogant and complacent because the government is going to carry on printing money to keep them in business. Now, that's got nothing to do with the free market. It's a political allocation of resources.
But Martin, you can
understand
to
the wealthy classes
by the government.
You can
understand why all politicians want to do this. They don't want to see a crash, do they? Nobody wants to see a crash.
I agree with that. And therefore, once you've bailed the banks out, the Labour government, the last Labour government, bent over backwards not to nationalise Northern Rock. It was the only thing to do. They should have done it on day one. But they spent weeks faffing around saying, and when they did nationalise, they said, well, no, we haven't really nationalised it. We've just given them a temporary help so that they can go back to the private sector. They're not going back to the private sector. They never were. If you had a solidly government-owned banking sector, it would outcompete the private sector almost straight away. So then the private sector would be destroyed just through natural competition. So what should have happened once you've bailed the banks out is we then end up with a 100% industry, financial services industry owned by the government, which was in fact in the Labour Manifesto of 1983. But of course, that was the biggest, longest suicide note in history. If we'd nationalised the banks in 1983, there wouldn't have been a crash in 2008.
We have nationalised several of the banks, RBS, NatWest, etc.
No, we haven't nationalised.
Well, you say that. I mean, we own 80% of RBS. But how accountable are they? If they do something, how many people go out in the streets? I think in the Netherlands, they own something like 20% of the banks nationally. And as soon as the banks try and do something wrong, or as it's considered wrong, or a bad investment or whatever, they're out in the streets and they're saying, you know, this is not right. We own 20% of the banks. We should be doing that here. And actually, I think we've all got an individual civic responsibility to say we own 80% of RBS. We should be doing something about it. I think the politicians have a civic responsibility to be saying
so,
to RBS.
Although they actually officially own it and own the shares, they've actually given a complete free rein to the directors of the banks.
Absolutely, and I think this does need to be challenged. And it was interesting what you were saying about QE, because it doesn't work. It's a false economy. And interestingly, I was at a debate a few weeks ago on kind of Europe, because obviously the European elections are coming up on the 22nd of May, and obviously I hope everyone will vote in those elections. And it was one of the Green candidates' main economic policies, actually, was around quantitative easing.
So what, stopping quantitative easing?
No, increasing it.
Increasing it?
Yeah.
What effect would that have, Martin?
Well, the problem with quantitative easing is it keeps the show on the road, and of course it's then led to the delusion that the crisis is over, which it isn't. But of course, when you try and rein back on quantitative easing, as they tried to do in the US earlier last year, it then sets off a panic, because they've now become addicted. It's like heroin. Yeah, you start using a bit of heroin, and it just gives you a buzz and you feel good. Then you do some more, and then suddenly you're scrabbling around because you've got to have your heroin. And then when you don't get your big fix of heroin, you start to go cold turkey. And the stock markets, as soon as they suggested that they were going to stop providing heroin, they all started to go cold turkey. Now, of course, then they started to give more put more. All right, we'll keep the heroin on. But ultimately, of course, the heroin will kill you if you don't kick it.
Okay.
Absolutely, it's a false economy.
Well, I can remember. I mean, this is back in the 1970s, I think it was. Then there was talk about printing money then, which is exactly the same as quantitative easing. And everyone was saying, "Oh gosh, this is terrible. This will never do. Impossible." But now it's part of the norm.
But you were printing money in the 1970s to keep real wages up and prevent collapse of the economy in terms of unemployment. They were now printing money to keep Hargreaves Lansdown in business, not the NUM.
Well, we mentioned the sell-off of Royal Mail last October, and the news was out on the April the 1st. I mean, it's a terrible day for news stories, but you have to have a look to see if it's a real news story. This one is Osborne's best man. His hedge fund made £36 million profit on the sale of Royal Mail. This is Osborne's university friend, Peter Davis, who was his best man. Lansdowne Partners, nothing to do with Hargreaves Lansdowne, made £100 million from the financial crash as well. And the ex-boss of Lansdowne Partners was given a knighthood after a £500,000 donation to the Tory party. But the main bulk story is that George Osborne's best man, who heads up this hedge fund, has secured profits of £36 million from the privatisation of Royal Mail in under 6 months. £210,000 for every day since the sale in October last year. Now, this looks a little bit like favouritism, Fari.
Yeah, I mean, essentially all I would say is, you know, same old Tories. It's kind of no surprise that this sort of thing would be built into the privatisation of one of our core services, the Royal Mail. So I would say there was kind of no surprise in terms of that.
Martin, this is Osborne's best man's company has done very, very nicely. Thank you very much.
All right, well, we could all, you know, snort with disgust. But just think about the macroeconomic effect of that. If somebody can make 36 million just by being chums with the Chancellor and being on the inside of the deal, why go and invent a better widget? Why come up with a better platform than Google? Why invent a cure for cancer? And of course, investment flows to where profits are to be made. The super profits are to be made in drug dealing and financial services, and they're interlinked. Why bother to do anything else? And that's what Britain trades on. We are hucksters. gangsters, well, that and that's is, all. That or is, that's that, what we're becoming.
That's quite a big claim that the financial services firm are drug dealers. What do you? Can you just
the UN office?
Give us some evidence.
The UN Office on Drugs and Crime issued a report in 2009, where they pointed out, and this is basically the world's top police officers are in this organisation, and they said what happened in 2008 when Lehman Brothers went down and everybody's panicking. The major drug cartels went to the banks and said, you guys have got a problem with money, haven't you? And they were going, yes, 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 we're having a panic. I said, do you know what? We've got loads. Do you want it? And they went, yes, 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 yes. And all the dirty money that had been sitting under the mattress and wherever just sucked into the banking system just like that. And you could argue, and I would argue, that the financial system was saved by only two things, the taxpayer and the drug cartels, with about equal weight to both of them. And that's the reality.
Onto a couple of transport stories now, and the publicly owned East Coast Mainline rail service is the best value. Official figures reveal this week it provides the best value for money for the taxpayer, returning a net surplus of £16 million to the government's coffers, and it's Britain's only publicly funded rail route, and it's a runaway success. The East Coast firm provides the best value for money for the taxpayer. Southwest Trains was the only private operator to provide a surplus. That was only £5 million. The top three payers of dividends, Northern Rail, TransPennine Express and Virgin Trains, paid out £97 million to shareholders instead. The figures come from Office of Rail Regulation report, which details the subsidy each train company receives, just how much they pay back in premiums to the Treasury. Vari, this is a bit of a no-brainer to me. Mm. Why on earth privatise the rail service if actually, instead of going to shareholders, that money will come back into the Treasury if you do it? And also, it's actually making more. It's a more efficient service.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a perfect example of why publicly owned transport works and why we should be pushing forward to nationalising the rail services. At the moment, I mean, we own the railways and then we lease out kind of trains to private companies that make huge profits.
Well, actually, it's the banks that own the rolling stock, a lot of them, through leasing companies. Mm.
Yeah.
We don't. The banks do. I mean, the HSBC is one of the biggest owners of...
Yeah.
Yeah, when you're sitting on a train going to London, you'll probably find that that train is owned by HSBC and leased to First Great Western. But anyhow, you know, what are your thoughts about privatisation, nationalisation of the railways? Because we get a pretty bad service, I'd say, here. I mean, over the years since it's been privatised, you seem to get less and less space on a train if you're going to London. Mm. You're squashed into the person. You've got to sit and watch some stupid advert in front of you. Less space. It's much, much better, surely, for this profit to be coming into the public purse rather than going into private hands.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I would agree. We should be looking forward to nationalising the rail services for those very
but
reasons.
Is the Labour Party nationally going to do it? Because I know the Labour Party was part of actually privatising this in the first place.
Mm.
Actually, it was John Major, but they have gone along with it. The Labour Party had many years in which they could have done something about this, and they did nothing.
I mean, obviously, I can't speak for what has happened in the past. I don't know specifically what the current Labour Party policy is on this. I do know that there's a lot of pressure groups that are pushing for the renationalisation of the railways. What we end up putting in our manifesto will come out, you know, closer to the election. But unfortunately, I can't give you an answer to that.
Martin,
today.
Mick Cash, who's the Acting General Secretary of the Rail, Maritime and Transport RMT Union, said the corporate welfare on Britain's railway continues unchecked, with the scroungers from the private train companies fleecing the British people for mind-blowing sums of money. The case for bringing the whole rail network under public ownership and ending the scandals of subsidy and revenue support is absolutely overwhelming. It's about time the politicians of all party took note. Well, I suppose the question is, why don't they?
Well, because what's happened is we did a lot of privatisation of the railways, one of the last and most destructive things of the Thatcher era, although that was carried out by John Major. And then, of course, once you've done that, it then becomes a huge bother to undo it. Similar with the health service reform.
Well, no, it wasn't with the East Coast Main Line,
well,
was it?
Well,
what
happened there, I understand, is that the private sector operators walked away because they couldn't manage it and then handed it back to the public sector. But, of course, all of these franchises do come up for renewal. And when they come up for renewal, you just don't put them out to tender.
First Great Western has just been extended.
Well, that's because the current government is committed ideologically to the idea of privatisation. We are now subsidising the railways in this country 300% more than we did under nationalisation, but people are taking profits from it. Now, when you think about all these profits, whether it's Osborne's chum getting Royal Mail or Virgin taking money out of the railway system, this is not building a better widget. There is no justification in the economics textbook for these people to have any of this money at all. And ultimately, they'll have no problem in taking it off them. If we take it off them, we're not causing inefficiency, we're not creating a situation where entrepreneurs are being punished. These people aren't entrepreneurs, they're a bit like the oligarchs in Russia. They've taken over what were existing national assets and used them for personal profit. And therefore, we can, without affecting efficiency in any way, we can take this stuff off them.
The way you're describing it, Martin, you know, we were talking about medieval times, but they sound like the sort of feudal barons.
Well, they
these,
are.
These oligarchs. We don't want to go back there, but maybe we're already there.
In the textbook, they call this rent-seeking. Yeah? Rent-seeking is where you get a kickback without doing anything. Whether you're owning land, like a landowner, or whether you're a shareholder in a privatised industry, which is a monopoly, you are rent-seeking. You're not, what you want to do if you want to encourage innovation in your economy is you want the entrepreneurs to have access to capital. Mm. The entrepreneurs are often people with no money at all. They're people with good ideas.
We're in this bizarre state, yep, aren't we, where if you've got about £15,000-18,000 to invest in an energy company like Scottish Southern Energy or somebody like that, you can invest that money in there and you never pay anything for your electricity again, or gas. Mm. And because the dividends from the shares are paying your bills. And then when it comes to maybe 10, 15 years' time when you want to cash your shares in, you've also had a massive increase in the value of your shares. But so essentially what's happening is the poor are paying the gas bills and electricity bills of the rich. Just sounds like Dennis Moore, you know, from Monty Python, steals from the poor and gives to the rich. Anyway, another transport story. That's just me. Yes, it's Good Friday. You have to allow me a little bit of leeway, I'm afraid, occasionally. Toyota recall. There's another one of my crazy headlines there. Recall of Toyota cars. And a Toyota recalling 6.4 million vehicles as a catalogue of safety issues are uncovered. In the Mirror, this is on the 10th of April. Recall covers 27 models worldwide, some dating back to 2004, as inspections are required to steering column brackets, engine starters, airbag cables, wiper motors and seat rails. Now, all sorts of crazy things have been happening with these Toyota cars. Really rather worrying. Over 35,000 UK registered vehicles are affected. The company said there were no reports worldwide of any accidents, injuries or fatalities linked to these issues. Well, that would be good if it was true, because certainly last time they said that, there were fatalities to do with what they called unintended acceleration. A lot of these, in the past, problems have been traced to the computer systems in the car, because a lot of cars now run on the little computer system. You know, if you're, for example, one of the things that's been happening here is seats have been going backwards in the car whilst they're driving along, meaning that they can no longer reach the controls of the car while they've got their seatbelt on. You know, so you have to take your seatbelt off and sort of perch on the edge of the seat in order to steer the thing. So all sorts of problems with these. But what we're getting into a kind of almost like 2001 world, Vari, where the technology is actually more dangerous. In fact, in a way, you could go back to a sort of old banger from the 1960s and you'd be safer than in one of these cars.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely crazy that they've recalled so many cars over the last kind of 4 or 5 years due to these issues. And it's surprising that, you know, they can get this far. But I think it does demonstrate kind of our huge reliance on computers and not actually on people spotting these issues before they're actually being sold. And
the other thing is they're vulnerable. We did a feature on this a couple of months ago. They're vulnerable to viruses. Mm. You know, so a car's computer is as vulnerable to a virus as your own home computer.
Yeah.
Viruses can be, as the lady from DARPA we had an interview with, was saying that you can actually have a CD, which looks like a perfectly normal CD to play, but it's got a virus in it. As you put it into your car seat, if you're still old-fashioned and you've still got a CD player, the CD plays normally, but it puts a virus onto the car's computer. Also, the diagnostic ports in garages, they can have viruses. So when they plug that into your computer, it's got a virus. Martin, this technology is running way ahead of itself.
Well, it's a continuation of what's been going on for a very long time. The car industry is a classic oligopolistic structure. That is to say, you can't really compete on an international scale with artisanal production. So you tend to have a small number of big producers, Toyota, Ford, whatever.
I mean, we've had Bristol cars, haven't we, which make classic cars. I don't think they actually make
cars.
Yeah,
but those are very niche markets, yeah? In general, the standard production for cars is oligopolistic. And oligopolistic means that you've basically got a small number of big producers. And the reason for that is because of the technology involved. You know, you can't build cars individually. You need a mass production line. And of course, what then happens is they can set their own prices. Yeah, just like the energy companies do. But that means that they then compete with each other. That if you look, that the prices of similar range cars are always the same, unless there's a price war on. But that means that they're then selling an idea of a car. So you get a built-in obsolescence. Like Ford in the 1970s, one of their cars, I can't remember the model of it, they had a petrol tank at the back, and whenever they were run into from the back, this tank would explode, and it was very dangerous. So eventually they identified this, and then they costed it out and said, we could bring all these cars back and remove all these petrol tanks, and we'd have to pay so much, or we can pay compensation for the people who get burned in the cars. Guess which one they decided to do. And that is the danger. All of these industries are not free markets. The free market doesn't exist, only in the textbook. In the real world, you've got real power in the hands of real company directors. And they don't, in fact, have... The market doesn't discipline them unless they're disciplined by the government.
In a way, I mean, I suppose I should say Toyota will recall. It's a bit unfair to just focus on them, because many of the other manufacturers have had serious problems with their cars, but they've managed the press side of it, the public relations side of it, much better. I know one of the first vehicles to have these kind of problems with the computers, where you press the accelerator and the car doesn't do what you're asking it to do. But they managed the PR situation, they managed the press, so that it didn't become a massive story as it has here, and they managed to contain it. But you know, certainly Toyota.
When people are buying a car, Tony, they're buying a dream, not a vehicle.
So there are, just to mention some of the names of the these models, earlier this year, Toyota recalled 2.1 million Prius, RAV4, Tacoma and Lexus vehicles because of a software problem that could cause cars to suddenly stop. A recall over 2009 and 2010 involved sticky accelerator pedals. Well, that's one way of putting it. They were saying it was the car mats or something that was causing it. Led to the callback of 10 million vehicles, and 2012 almost 7.5 million were affected by a problem with the power windows. God knows what that's something. I suppose just if you've got your arm on the window, the power window shoots up or something. Anyway, I guess that's just about it for this hour. Joining us has been, helping us review the news, has been Vary Threlfall. We'll be back after the news.
Community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, a British teenager killed in a battle in Syria has been described by his dad as a martyr who he says died for a just cause. Abu Baker Degeyes says he's tried to convince his 18-year-old son Abdullah, who was from Brighton, not to fight in the war-torn country. But he says he believes that he and his two brothers went to Syria to defend innocent civilians. Here's Abdullah's friend, Louise Tierney.
Everyone's devastated for the fact that he's gone. He's left so many friends behind. He was loved by so many people and he was well known around here. He was got on with everyone. Everyone's just so devastated and just can't believe that it's happened.
A man's been shot dead in West Belfast. Police are investigating.